Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Doon Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings, warriors, and welcome to Bound by Honor, the KAG Book Review Podcast. And with me today, as always, is Jorn.
Hello, everyone.
And Juvon.
Hello.
And today we're going to take a look at a book called How Much for Just the Planet, a Star Trek original series book, number 36 by John M. Ford. This book is different than a lot of the ones that I've read, and I'll just start out with a brief synopsis. Large deposits of dilithium are detected on a colony planet known as Direde. The delegations from the United Federation of Planets and the Klingon Empire are sent to negotiate for mining rights. Both factions are prevented from openly fighting for the rights by the Organian Peace Treaty as imposed in the original series episode Errand of Mercy. Both the Federation and Klingon crews find the inhabitants of the planet very strange as they occasionally break into song to explain their narratives and seemingly attack the visitors. There are numerous adventures between the people on the planet and the crews of the ships that have been designed by the Doradians to make them more amenable under what they call Plan C, the C meaning comedy. In the end, the Doradians get what they want as neither party will mine the entire planet, and all will work together to their mutual benefit. So that is the story we're looking at. And I think we'll start out with the overall impressions, and I think this time we'll start with you, Sean. What did you think of this book? Or not what did you think of it, but what were your overall impressions?
Overall impressions? I wasn't particularly impressed with this book. Oh. To me, it felt like a very confused mess in the last few chapters that had very little payoff.
Okay. But if you look at what this book is, and that is Star Trek meets screwball comedy, that's exactly what's supposed to happen. This is written in the style of the screwball comedies of the 1930s, 1940s that we saw in the movies.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll tell you, my overall impressions were kind of in line with Sean's. I did not really care for this book. It would not hold my attention at all. There were a few moments in it that I thought were pretty humorous, and I kind of enjoyed, and I chuckled a little bit, but for most of the book, I was kind of lost. I just did not feel like the Enterprise characters in particular were being themselves. It just didn't seem to gel for me.
And it felt like the Klingons were being forced into the roles that they had to do, mostly based on the Organian Peace Treaty. But I also found, having watched lots of screwball comedies years ago, a lot of the plot lines in the book were really predictable to me, knowing that you throw people into this scenario and these are the outcomes you're going to get.
For me, this kind of smacked of Gilbert and Sullivan type humor. One of my favorite Gilbert and Sullivan operettas is Pirates of Penzance. And this one was, every time a song would come up or something like that, I would think of Pirates of Penzance, just start singing for no particular reason. However, to me, this did not seem like the very model of a modern Star Trek novel.
No, it isn't, but there were a couple of those songs that I almost did set to a Gilbert and Sullivan song tune.
I don't think I would ever watch it as a movie, but this would have been better suited to actually be a television play or something. Like, I got really lost in the last chapter where I'm trying to figure out who were, or not the last chapter, the third last chapter, where they're following that double date thing. It got hard after a while to figure out whose perspective it was, at least in my version, because it wouldn't give me like that two-line gap so that you know when it's changing perspective. So I got really confused after a while of who I was following and what was going on.
I think you're right there, because screwball comedies are a visual comedy, and it is very hard to write a screwball comedy.
Yes.
Well, yeah, the way this was seemed to work to me was it was supposed to be more of a bunch of sight gags, and it just didn't translate into literature very well.
I think the best way to read this particular book literally is to read it as fast as you can. Not try to use John Ford's descriptions so much as try to put your own descriptions into it, your own scenes and backgrounds into it. Just keep it moving. But then again, that's what a screwball comedy is, continuous movement.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's go in and start talking about characters. John, why don't you lead us through this?
Well, obviously, being a Star Trek original series book, we've got the usual cast of characters. Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Sulu, Scotty, Uhura, Chekhov. But we've also thrown in a Federation ambassador, Charlotte Sanchez. And, you know, without her, like you were talking earlier, Sean, that double date plot point would not even bother to hold up. She could not have been a part of the Enterprise crew because she would have known what Kirk's reactions were going to be. And you needed that surprise to make the whole plot, that whole plot point work. From there, you also had the crew of Jefferson Randolph Smith. Again, a motley crew. But how many times have you guys seen in Star Trek books the aerial race thrown into the mix here? The way we had a Vulcan, I think a human, and a flyer on that crew.
I don't recall seeing a great deal of that.
They were introduced to canon in the animated series episodes.
Okay. So, you know, again, like the last book, that the last John Ford book that we looked at, he likes to bring in those outside of the original series people in, like people from the animated series.
Yeah, I believe this was written in 84, so it was definitely after the animated series.
87.
Oh, there you go.
So despite the fact that it's written now a couple of movies after the Klingon dictionary has come out, we're still using Klingon Ace as the language in John Ford's books. But that, of course, brings us to the crew of the Fire Blossom. Captain Caden, Commander Arizaha, Chief Engineer Azade, Security Officer Magnus, and Ensign Korth, who are going to team up with their counterparts on the Enterprise to go through, shall we say, madcap performances.
Or madcap negotiations, as the case may be.
Well, as we get to the end of the book, we find out they are performances.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, the characters, especially the Enterprise characters, did not ring true. Except maybe for Spock. He wasn't on the planet, but I do have to admit, I was amused by McCoy, who seemed to be very concerned with getting fed.
I think McCoy was the only one really acting like his own character through all of it. Everybody else was just acting really odd.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree with that.
There was a point in reading the book, I was kept expecting some sort of agent in the planet was affecting all the characters to, you know, the Enterprise people acting one way, the Klingons not being as aggressive as you normally think of them as. But you never saw that pop up. You never saw that turn make itself happen.
Yeah, I was expecting something like that too. Like the whole, they're making a video of the blackmail of them didn't particularly surprise me, but I was surprised that there's nothing in the air making them act the way they were.
I was very disappointed with the Klingons. I mean, after a certain amount of this silliness, and the book is just plain silly. After a certain amount of silliness, I would expect a Klingon to say, to heck with this treaty, we're moving forward with this.
Yeah, simply to test the treaty would be the least of their reactions.
And at one point in the book, they do discuss that if they all out start fighting over the planet, it would probably be brought into the Organian peace treaty. And at one point, I was wondering if these people are trying to force them into a conflict so that they would be protected by the Organian treaty, and then end up not even being the idea that they had, which made the whole story even more confusing.
And speaking of the Organian treaty, hot cream pies.
Yeah, big pie fight at the end. This was definitely slapstick.
Yeah, I'm like, I could go on all day.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just confused that they introduced a couple of ideas that could have played out in the climax to be a part of the resolution, and they ended up, like, the whole starship, the Smith starship, had no bearing on the plot except it attracted the Federation's attention, but they almost, if you just removed them from the plot and the Enterprise just showed up, you would pretty much get the same thing out of the plot. And on top of that, they introduced this whole idea of the training decoys, only for at the end it just to land on a glass roof and they all get confused. It could have played out a little bit. Those could have been used a little bit more. I thought they would have more to do with the finale than they did. It just seemed pointless by the time they got to the end and had no relevance to the actual plot.
I had completely forgotten about the balloons, the full-size ship balloons. Did I get that right, or did I mess that up?
No,
that's actually from the animated series. There was an episode where they had decoy ships that were inflated.
Oh, see, I forgot about that. It's just in the book itself, it just seemed really pointless. But I guess if it was already based off of established thing, like, it kind of makes a little bit more sense that he was a little bit more nonchalant about being there. Where to me, as not recognizing as a previous plot point, it feels like it should have to introduce something like that to do nothing with it really doesn't benefit the story.
No, I think you're right on the first your first point there, Sean. Even though it is in a series and had been used somewhere else, if it doesn't have something to do with the plot, if it doesn't drive the plot forward in some manner, why is it there? And in this case, why were they there? There were three of them, and they only used the one kind of like.
Well, we could go on and talk about the residents of the planet, Flighter. To me, that guy, he seemed to be kind of a Harry Mudd clone.
If you look at the cover of the book, you definitely get the impression that he's a Harry Mudd-like character, because that's the way he's drawn in this case.
That would have been an interesting idea if it was actually him. That's what I was expecting at the end, because of the picture. I was expecting it to turn out to be Mudd the whole time.
But that'd be a whole other story, because Mudd would have taken this whole scenario that he had, sitting on a huge dilithium crystal, and two races to negotiate over it, that would have gone in a whole different direction.
Yeah, he would have been way more mercenary and figuring ways around to get profits for himself. Actually, I think another thing Harry Mudd would have done was to take a bit of revenge against Kirk and probably just turn the planet over to the Klingons.
Well, based on what we've seen in Discovery so far, that may not have been the case. But again, this book was written long before the new Star Trek series came out.
True.
Okay. We got to talk about the songs.
Sure.
Yes, there were songs.
Lots of songs.
Lots of songs.
Lots.
And Klingons love songs, but I'll tell you what, I only found one, and I can't even remember which one it is, that kind of amused me.
I was amused at first, and then once...
The biggest problem with songs in a book like this, unless you have the musical melody in your mind that actually fits it, it becomes a little bit difficult to read the cadence of a song because it's not the same cadence as normal dialogue or normal script reading.
Yeah. I was amused with it at first, but then I forget what her name was, but the Black Queen or whatever, once she started singing, I'm just like, oh, we're going to be doing this all book, aren't we?
And it did. And I wish I could remember which song it was, but John, you are exactly right. I could not pick up on what songs were in the book except for the one. Then when I looked it up doing a little bit of research for the show, I found out what some of the other ones are, but this thing pushed me away so far, I didn't even bother go back and try to sing them in my mind.
That was the same, except you put a little bit more effort into it than I did.
I think you probably put way more effort into it than the average reader would have done. A little notation at the bottom of the page or next to where it starts, would have put the tune in the reader's mind, and the reader probably would have found that passage more enjoyable once they knew what the melody was supposed to be.
Well, and then younger readers, even then, younger readers wouldn't know the songs that were brought up in there, but I would have appreciated a parenthetical remark saying to the tune of whatever.
I hate to say it, but younger readers wouldn't realize what a screwball comedy was supposed to be.
I wonder if this was meant to be like a high-end audiobook, like the hire actors to take on each part instead of just having one reader. It's supposed to be a bit of a production behind it.
I don't know when audiobooks became really, really prevalent. I'm thinking it was the 90s, so this may be a just before that wave hit.
Because to me, it felt like this should have been, like I said, a screenplay, or it just should have been a high-end audiobook where they hired a bunch of actors to do all the different roles.
I think with a really good director, this might have worked better visually.
I don't know. You could have, like Sean is saying, if you'd have gotten a decent director, I think it was Alien Voices that Leonard Nimoy and John DeLancey put together, they could have made it so that you would seen the scenes because of the vocalizations and the sound effects.
Yeah, the DeLancey and Nimoy thing, those were really, really good because they understood their characters and it came through as themselves. And even in the second edition where DeLancey and Nimoy switched their characters and were acting like each other, it still worked.
But we perfected old-time radio over the decades. BBC is still working on old-time radios. You've literally got a Doctor Who series of radio plays that are still being made. So you wouldn't have had to read it. You could have actually made it into a audio drama of some sort.
I agree. So we have songs, Dilithium. How about some of the things that happened? This is the part of the book that just completely lost me, is what was going on. We had Scotty, and he was in a golf game with somebody, and Uhura shopping trip.
That wasn't a golf game. That was a golfing duel. Scotty was challenged, and he picked his weapon, golf clubs.
Ah. McCoy in the dungeon, Kirk's hotel, and screwball comedy, which absolutely, I almost stopped reading the book at that point.
To be honest, I probably wouldn't have finished it if it wasn't for we were reading for this podcast.
I have to agree. I think I'd have put it down after the first chapter, about halfway through the second chapter, saying, what the heck is this?
It's a chapter with the double date that I probably would have stopped, because it makes the whole time lapse. Like, what were they doing all day while everybody else was missing that they didn't notice everybody else was missing? Like, just questions like that. Like, they didn't... I just feel bad, like, hammering on a book this old.
I read this book right after I got on vacation, and I have to agree, I have felt bad all week and have been afraid to record this because it's just, I can't find anything really redeeming about it. And to be completely fair, Goodreads shows this at a 3.6 out of 5 star approval rating.
I'm wondering if that's because this particular book, either you like it, it's your type of humor, or you don't. There's no middle ground. And most reviewers, I'm assuming this is the way with Goodreads, most reviewers are going to want to say something good about a book, not just flat out trash it. So they're getting all the good ones, but it'll skew it up, and none of the really, you know, horrible ones.
I find it's like that on IMDb too, like with older movies and shows. It's if somebody's going out of their way to do a review on it, they probably either A, really liked it, or B, they really hated it. So then the results get skewed that way.
Yeah.
We're seeing that in real time right now. They're thinking that a lot of the bad press, bad fan reactions to The Last Jedi are coming from bots that are trying to skew the results in a particular direction.
Oh, no kidding. I did not know that.
I've heard that too, and I would almost be inclined to agree because I actually really like that movie. It's one of the few times I really agree with the critics more than the audience score.
I went back yesterday and saw Last Jedi and picked up on a lot of things that I missed on the first viewing, and I think it's a great movie.
One of the things that I wanted to go back and pick up on, and I hate to do this during a CAG podcast, but did Luke on the sand desert at the end leave any footprints?
I don't remember if he did, but like even the dice they gave Leia disappeared at one point.
They made a pretty big deal out of that, actually, and he did not leave any footprints because under the what was apparently a light snow covering, every time somebody would move, that red salt would come up, and Luke did not
appear. Yeah,
he did not disturb
it. The lightsaber he was using in that whole duel was not his lightsaber.
We're gonna have to put a spoiler warning at the top of this for The Last Jedi if we keep on talking about it.
I think we're gonna have to edit this whole Last Jedi part out.
Oh, bummer.
I keep it. I can use it for that extras podcast I'm trying to build.
Well, I'd be inclined to leave it in, but this is not the Last Jedi podcast. It is Bound by Honor, and we are looking at this book, so we should probably get back on track.
Welcome to Bound by Jedis.
You guys talked about the double dating scene, which is basically, if I'm thinking the right one that you guys are talking about, it literally is the last scene where Kirk and Charlotte and the two Klingons are having the double date to help the two Romeo and Juliets get together, so that reminded me a lot of the old Pink Panther movies is what he was striving for.
Oh, yeah, that would make a little bit more sense now that you put in that context.
Well, I could see that scene playing out in my mind as a wide shot and people running back and forth into rooms and looking for each other and losing each other and the
clothes
wrong people meeting up.
And
yeah.
I mean, I knew as soon as Kirk had to put the cat suit on, it was going to disintegrate on him.
As soon as they mentioned that both sides were trying to set them up, I go, this is not good. This is just a rom-com in a sci-fi channel.
It's not going to end. This is not going to go the way you think.
Yeah, I had no idea by the middle of the book. I didn't even remember what the hell they were there for.
Yeah, I was getting to that point too, and when the Smith crew kept on popping up, it took me a little bit to realize who they were.
And they never explained why they were keeping the Smiths crew away from the main action, because the denizens of the planet went out of their way to send them off in different directions.
And here's another thing that confuses me too. So this has all come down to they want to blackmail the captain of Kirk and Kaden. And they send them the tapes of the pie fight. And the idea is that if this ever breaks down, we're going to release the pie fight videos. Okay, that's fair. But if you bring this back to the type of operation that Starfleet is, this really has nothing to do with Starfleet. This is more of a Federation thing. So Kirk being there is more of a coincidence than anything else. He wouldn't be the point man for the rest of his life on this, even if he wanted to be. So eventually some other captain's going to be put in charge of it, or an admiral's going to be put in charge of it, and he's not going to care about Kirk's thing. If he hates Kirk, he might actually go of his way to get this video released.
Oh, I thought that the videos were given to each of the captains so that they would stay in line, not necessarily the Federation or the Klingons, because they had the doomsday weapon against the other one.
No, I get why they did it, but to me it's okay, Kirk and that captain are being kept in line, but what about everybody else in Starfleet or the Klingon Empire who's gonna be involved in this? They might not care. Like, Kirk having this video is really inconsequential in the larger scheme of both of those organizations. That's one captain who's being kept in line. But what if the Federation Council doesn't care about it and they just want that planet? It's not going to matter that Kirk has this video about him.
Actually, the deal they brokered, the deal that the Klingons and the Federation got, was a sweet deal for either side, in that one side was officially in charge and the other side did all the work and they split all the profits.
Which makes the whole plot even more pointless. They could have just said that right off the bat.
Well, you never know how paranoid a culture can get when they haven't been spacefaring for a while.
The Klingons would have not been impressed with that video, though. I think that poor captain would have probably been drummed out of the service pretty quickly.
Oh, that's fair if that one captain is being kept in line, but I'm saying just because they were there to broker the deal doesn't mean they're always going to be the person that the point man of the operation. Like, it's not every time they need to bring, they're not going to be always necessarily the people picking up the materials or doing the splitting or all that other stuff. When other captains get involved in and screw it up, it's probably not going to matter to them that these videos get released about other captains.
Sean, are you trying to bring rationality and intelligence into a screwball comedy?
Yes.
Well, I think
you missed something.
I think having no point and everybody winding up equal in the book is probably what the point of the book is.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think you've hit that nail pretty squarely on the head.
So it was just a slapstick. It was supposed to be just a comedy, and it really had no direction. So I guess maybe it accomplished what it set out to do.
Just
that's fair. I definitely
just 253 pages of utter nonsense.
I think that my biggest problem with the book is that for the amount of time that the investment to get to that solution was not worth my time. I think that's what frustrates me more than anything else, is that they had so much going on. The plot could have been so much more complex than that and it ended up being really nothing.
So we took a steak and turned it into a bologna sandwich.
Yeah, I guess that's basically the best way to describe it.
It could have been more tightly plotted, more woven together, but you never know. This was the 80s. We don't know how long John had to put this book together. I think he had a lot more time to organize his thoughts on the final reflection than he did here with this book.
Oh, probably. It probably got pushed to the front because the release, that looks like at least a drawing of Christopher Lloyd as a Klingon on the front cover. So they were probably pushing out anything that was Klingon related at the time.
Let's move on to favorite points of plot, if there are any. Jorn, let's have you start with this one because you seem to be a little more positive about this than I am.
Or me.
Well, the problem with this book and the genius of this book is that there really isn't a plot. It's such a simplified thing that what you're reading it for is each of the individual scenes, each of the individual adventures that occur. And it seems to me that the book is set up that we're going to take care of all the adventures of all of the other crew members for both the Enterprise and the Fire Blossom before we get to the main event, the double date, the dinner, the madcap adventures that goes on in the hotel late night. So you can just read individual pieces of it and they'll stand on their own, but not hold together for a plot. You know, I suppose that's the best I could say about it.
Okay. And Sean, were there any redeeming points of the plot for you in this?
I like the way a lot of them started, but the payoff for a vast majority of them were not that great. A lot of them, it felt like this could have been the entire story to itself. And if there was a little bit more focus put on it, it could have been a more interesting story. I guess I was really interested in.
Now, I kind of liked the opening because it did kind of pull me in a little bit. But then, you know, it lost me again. So I really didn't find anything in the book that particularly endeared me to it or made me want to read it again.
Well, here's another thing about plot points. Going back to the beginning of the book, what is going on with the blue pancakes?
I know, that's another plot that has nothing, like the whole thing with the computer on the Smith. There could have been something about, because it's self-intelligence, it could have saved everybody, but what happened to that? Went absolutely nowhere.
It literally just got dropped from the story. They never fixed the computers. They never fixed the replicators. It just died.
If it was something in the atmosphere that was doing it, and it turned out that they couldn't mine it because their computers would kill them eventually, that would have been an interesting resolution.
But the Enterprise systems were acting up long before they got the distress signal from the Smith.
You're right. And same with the Klingons. They hadn't even shown up yet. And they were, something about the orange juice was the wrong color or something weird like that.
Absolutely right taste. Absolutely right amount of pulp. But it wasn't orange.
Maybe those little things in themselves were supposed to be comedic. I don't know. You know, the computer that was barfing pink, milkshake or whatever or it was.
Like yeah, peppermint pink milkshake.
Yeah, I think that's what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to set up the fact that this is going to be a humorous novel. But you never explained it. If you don't explain it, if you leave that hanging, the reader feels unsatisfied, going, what is this here for?
Yeah, especially when they start introducing the idea of this computer can think on its own, but they want white system and reprogram to normal, but the computer won't let them because it wants to keep on being as it is. This very interesting concept introduced just to be thrown away and never addressed again.
I think I was so busy trying to slog through this thing that I didn't even care about what the computer was doing or what color the orange juice was or any of that other stuff. It was just a slog fest from beginning to end.
This book has a lot of interesting ideas that could have been mined to have, like, each of these interesting ideas, if you'd just taken them and written an entire book about it, it probably would have been an interesting book. But it's just, I think it's like a case of they threw too much at the wall and none of it's sticking.
Yeah, too many threads were left hanging to really make this a coherent book. Now, even saying that, you know, I did say earlier, it's a screwball comedy and they don't necessarily get tied up logically, but in a screwball comedy, they don't get dropped.
Yeah, the bizarre resolution of all the different threads is half of the fun of a screwball comedy.
Yeah.
And this computer scenario is a point, is an idea, something, a thread that they just dropped.
I don't know. I don't know where to go from there.
Yeah, I felt like you did, Jim, like 2 days before it, I was talking to my wife about the book. At one point she goes, well, why don't you guys just not review it and just choose another book? And I'm like, well, we're 2 days away from recording and there's no way we can read another book.
And we've already advertised that we're doing it.
Well, and let's face it, you know, there's good books out there and there's not so great books out there. And, you know, it deserves attention, good or bad, right or wrong.
The Final Reflection, his earlier book, was talked about extensively in the Klingon language panels that we had at Starbase Indy over Thanksgiving weekend. So, you know, you see that type of a book. To move on to this one, yeah, John Ford took a chance, and maybe it just didn't quite work out this time.
It's unfortunate because, after the last podcast, I wasn't crazy about the book, and maybe it was an issue of there's a lot of hype behind the importance of the book, so I went into expecting to have some revelations about the Klingon culture and all this stuff. And then to move to this book, which I don't particularly care for, it's unfortunate for the author because now I'm kind of turned off from going after anything that has to do with him.
It started me thinking about the very few humorous episodes of Star Trek original series, because, you know, Mudd, where he's occupied the planet and reprogrammed all the androids to do his bidding and things like that, was a hilarious episode. And even the screwball stuff that was going on when they were trying to confuse Norman in that episode, it was funny, it was goofy and silly, but it worked. However, there was a serious element to that story.
Look at Shore Leave, which is another one of those where you had all kinds of little dramas going on, you know, as a playground, but there was a serious thread that tied it all together.
That was another episode I was going to cite, and a lot of goofy stuff happened, but there's always that serious undertone all the way through that something is at stake here. And perhaps John Ford was trying to recapture that feeling from the original series, and it just kind of fell short.
Yeah, I do kind of get that impression that he definitely was going for the goofier thing. So maybe it was kind of like, maybe it was a bit of a passion project to be, maybe always wanted the right for Star Trek, and maybe always wanted to do a comedy episode, and this was a little bit of a passion project for him.
Yeah. And then, there's the just a few days ago, the Trouble with Tribbles episode 2, another one that it had serious undertones, but it was a comedic episode. You know, and then again, taken to the next level, if you consider the Deep Space Nine episode where everybody goes back in time.
Trial and Tribulations, that's the name of the episode.
Yeah, that was an awesome episode. Very well done. Let's move on to some themes, which were a little bit difficult for me to find. Thankfully, Jorn pulled my butt out of the fire on this one and came up with some themes. Fighting occupation through comedy.
You saw a little bit of this in Aaron and Mercy. Well, they didn't use comedy. They used disinterest for their own survival as a method of just dealing with the situation. But if you don't have weapons to turn back your opponent, to turn back your occupier, what other resources do you have? And these guys could apparently build a set overnight. So, comedy.
Yeah.
The comedy, though, and I'm not disagreeing with you at all. The comedy, I think, was part of the inhabitants' plan to keep things from getting overly serious and have fighting break out on their planet between the Klingons and the Federation, kind of maybe a opposite of what happened on Organia.
I honestly thought up until the pie fight thing that they were actually provoking a conflict.
But yeah, but it would be a comedic conflict rather than a shooting war, which of course now if you get a shooting war, we're going to have death and destruction. And if you have a comedy, a slapstick war with pies and things like that, you've got a little bit of cleanup, but nothing really gets destroyed and nobody really gets hurt, except for maybe their pride.
Yeah, and it seemed like most of that, the pie fight, was to break the tension.
I was just under the impression that they were forcing a conflict so that they would be protected under the Organian Treaty so that they would never have to worry about being harmed in the future. Obviously, that wasn't their ultimate plan. It was ultimately just blackmail.
Well, the problem with that is
until the end.
The problem with that is under the Organian Treaty, whether it's the Federation or the Klingons, whoever comes in and is able to develop the planet better than the other awarded the planet. And these guys didn't want their planet awarded to either one.
See, and I got that at the end, but when with the whole blackmail thing, they just didn't want to be really controlled by other parties. But I've been that's where I thought it was going, just for it to be kind of, I just wasn't very satisfied with the resolution. That's what it gets down to.
So, well, then the planet's inhabitants are the ones that come out on top, because we have the Federation who is going to administer the mining, and we have the Klingons that are going to do the work, and the people of the planet, they're just going to sit back and collect the profits.
And isn't that the way any country that has vast natural resources should be operating?
Well, that seems to be the way it works, yeah. So, well, let's look at the third theme that Jorn came up with, never assume anything. Could you explain that?
In a screwball comedy like this, anytime you think a situation is going to go in a particular direction, this book tries to build a new stage overnight and swing you where you weren't figuring it was going to go. I believe there was something that went on. I can't remember now exactly, but there was something that happened during the golfing match that kind of threw it off at the end.
Something about they got to a bar and people are just being weird there, and they went outside and they started being hit with mortars. It was really that part. That was one of those sections where I'm like, I don't understand what's happening.
Well, people were being weird everywhere through this book.
Yeah, I think the bar thing made sense because I think it was after the ninth hole and you usually take a break there and have some sort of thing. But then it spun into, like you said, that mortar attack, and it just went off in a different direction than golfing. But if you assume they were going to play the last nine holes, that's not going to happen.
That's fair.
So basically never assume anything would be the plot device of misdirection and putting the twists in there.
And misdirection was what these inhabitants were famous for. Well, not famous for. And misdirection was what the planet's inhabitants love to do best.
You know, I guess I can appreciate that, because the Star Trek books I have read, a lot of the Star Trek books I have read, are quite predictable. I mean, we know that the heroes are going to be just fine, unless it's a David Mack book, because anybody could die at any time in a David Mack book. You never know what's going to happen with them. But in a lot of the Star Trek books, you can kind of predict as things go along. There's a formula they follow. And the major heroes are probably going to wind up being just fine. And maybe this is just an attempt to make it more unpredictable. Because, you know, when you watch the show, you know that certain things are going to happen. You know who's going to land on their feet at the end, and maybe we needed some unpredictability at that point.
That is fair. One my favorite Star Trek series that I followed more than any of the others is called New Frontier. One of the things I like about it is that it kind of exists in its own bubble up until the relaunch era. Kind of existed in its own, like, basically universe where they're just taking throwaway characters, throwing them together, and people were dying, moving on, things were happening. And that was the most interesting thing about it, is that the possibility for death was actually real, where the other books, it's, you knew by the end of it, it's like an episode, everything wrapped up with a bow and it was back to normal.
I read all of the New Frontier series books by Peter David, and I'll tell you what, I really would have liked to have seen that series made into a TV thing.
Yeah, that would have made been very interesting, because it's basically like a Next Generation spinoff, because it's all characters that were or mostly characters that are just throwaways from Next Generation.
Yeah, Picard sponsored McKenzie into Starfleet Academy in the very early novels.
Yeah, it was part of the first, I think it was in the second one where they addressed that, because I think the first one was just backstory. The first four were very short books, and they usually release them as one now. And then Shelby's the commander from The Best of Both Worlds. And Salar is the Vulcan doctor that's kicking around in the background in a few episodes.
Yeah, there's a, as you say, there's a lot of throwaway characters in that series.
All of Worf's buddies from the Academy, from the Star Trek Academy book series, are all on that ship, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to closing thoughts on Final Reflection. John, you want to walk us through this?
This book was written after the dictionary came out by a couple of years. But Ford goes on to continue using the Klingon Ace instead of Klingon Hall language. And the guys who are into the Klingon Language Institute at Star Trek, at Starbase Indy, were talking about that as Klingon Ace was a second variation on the Klingon language from Klingon Hall. But that doesn't really feature into this novel. It's just mentioned a couple times. You really can't figure the words out because you can't go to the dictionary and look them up in this case. But this is not a serious look at Star Trek. It's not a serious look at the philosophies of the Federation or the Klingon Empire. You get nothing about Klingonness, what it's like to be a Klingon, from this book. It is just a silly screwball comedy.
I would have to agree with that. And as far as my closing thoughts on How Much for Just the Planet, I've read it. I'm done with it. I will probably never, ever pick it up again, and I certainly would not recommend it.
I think we rated it out of 5 last, the Final Reflection, so what would you give it out of 5?
I'd probably go as high as a 3.
I couldn't go any more than 1.
I'd probably actually go with a 2, just because I know I've read a worse Star Trek book than this.
I hesitate to ask which one.
Dwellers in the Crucible.
Okay, I've never read that.
I think I've got it, but I can't remember. I don't think I've read it, or I can't even remember the author.
I think you've probably heard me complain about it before. It's kind of what brought up the idea of doing book reviews in the first place, is that I was bitching about this book.
Well,
okay. Well, let's not give it any more airtime then.
All
right. Fair enough.
Our overall rating for this book is a solid 2. Out of 5 stars, that would be, well, let's see. Actually, it would be 2 dilithium pies out of 5. And that's kind of where this one is lying. Apparently, we weren't all that impressed with it.
Is that 2 dilithium cream pies?
Yeah, there you go. 2 dilithium cream pies out of 5.
Do you guys, after we did the last one, and it's actually kind of why I found the Goodreads website, do you guys take the time to go and write a review now that we're doing this type of stuff?
I usually don't.
No, I haven't.
I found since we did the first one that, because I read a lot of stuff back to back, I find that I've started not only rating it, but I've found that what I am more moved to write quick reviews, one or two sentences about stuff now on Amazon or on Goodreads now that I'm on there.
I think I would be more inclined to do that with more current books that we read.
Speaking of Goodreads, if anybody would like to add me on there, I've started a Bound by Honor group, and it would be nice to get other people on there, not only to see what they're reading, but to see what people actually think about the book leading up to podcasts. Just more of curiosity, because if people make good points or whatever, we can bring it up and talk about it in the podcast. You can look for my email, commanderwarf@hotmail.com, and I should pop up as Sean.
Okay, and so, Sean, what are we reading next?
We are reading Star Trek Klingon by Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Roush. This is adaption of a game, or maybe the game is an adaption of the book. They were both released in the same year around the same time, so this could be a chicken and the egg issue. If anybody has a playthrough of the game, we would be interested in seeing your playthroughs. I know I'm in the middle of watching one already. But I think this is going to be an interesting book to read just because it's also a video game at the same time. It'd be interesting to compare the two to each other.
And if anybody wants to catch the Klingon Linguistics podcast from Starbase Indy, you'll hear Robert O'Reilly and Mark Okrand talking about the making of the library disc from that particular game.
Oh, good point. That's something I should listen to before we record this episode so that we can talk about it too, about all of it at once.
Now, is this the game that I remember from maybe 20 years ago that actually had a module on it? You could learn to pronounce Klingon words correctly?
It's the videos that we used in the Klingon cursing panel, Jim, are from that particular game system. Yes, the entire story was directed by Jonathan Frakes.
Yeah, I just found that out today when while I was waiting to record. I thought I'd do a little research on it, and I found that out today. I didn't realize he directed it. That's actually really cool.
I think I had that game, and I even tried it, but I don't have a great deal of time for games, so I probably didn't get very far through it.
To be fair, the walkthrough I'm watching, it seems like the guy's taking his time to go through each selection, and the video is only like, I think, just under 2 hours. It can't be that long of a game.
It's not that long of a book. But I think, guys, we ought to save all this for next time on Bound by Honor.
Okay, Sean, where do people find us?
You can first, if you want to find us on Goodreads, just add me on Goodreads, and I'll add you to the group if you don't find it through my profile, or at Facebook/KegPodcast, or you could just look up Keg Podcast on Instagram or Twitter, and you'll find us there, or just on the regular website. You can find us at keg.org/podcast. Or we're on iTunes and Google Play, depending on where you're listening to this.
Excellent. Well, we'll just wrap it up for today. There it is. And I am Ja Jim.
I'm Jorn.
I'm Javon.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor. Kapla.
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 You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!